Good evening. Welcome to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Enter freely and of your own will. In this episode, you may find many strange things, for the films to be discussed are old, and they have many memories. So, beware. Beware.
Welcome back to another episode of the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. This is Jim Towns, your host, and I'm with returning champion David Ullman to talk about this episode. How you doing, David?
I'm great. Great. Glad to be back.
All the way from Minnesota.
Yeah, don't you know?
just learned you're from there. That's cool. Yes, great. Great to have you back on. What was the last time when you did with me? Was it Vampyr?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I got Vampyr, right? Two really good ones in a row. Extra psyched.
They were talking. We are going to talk about what we were just discussing before we started recording, I think is maybe the oldest film we have yet talked about on the podcast, the earliest film. It's a silent movie. It stars John Barrymore, and it is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the 1920 version, made by Paramount and produced by Adolf Zukor, who also produced the 1931 Frederick March version, which David also spoke with me on about that. So you're kind of my go-to Jekyll and Hyde guy. I've just realized this. That's cool. There's like a nice gizmet to that.
Great honor. Yeah, I'm so thrilled.
I'd like to do the little synopsis at the top, right? That's been one of my more recent things doing the episodes of the film. And I like to put it in my own words. And I did two for this one. Oh. I did one when I started, before I started watching, and one after I finished watching it. And the first one is, in his quest to understand the darker side of humanity, Dr. Henry Jekyll unwittingly unleashes the evil within himself.
Nice.
And after watching the movie the other night and making notes, I added a second one alternatively. And it reads, a man turns himself into a monster so he can hook up with a prostitute. Which really, when I stepped back, I was like, hang on. And I'm going to talk about this in a little bit in this episode. This is a very, I don't want to call it neutered, but it's a very, the amount of evil, with the one big exception, the amount of evil Hyde does in this movie is sort of debatable. I'm not sure if he's... He kills a guy, and that's bad, and nobody should do that, obviously. But except for that, you know, it's the one thing he does kind of right at the end. And except for that, I'm not sure if Hyde is evil in this movie or just kind of naughty. Yeah,
these are very horny
and
movies.
And funny looking. Yeah, well, that's... And I want to talk about, there's a lot of 1920s, very... And it's almost teens culture, because this is 1920. So we're not into like roaring 20s here that we all think about flappers and Lollapaloozas and, you know, everything, swing dancing. it's more like a 19-teens, very conservative culture this comes out of, kind of. As opposed to the 1880s when the book was written. Obviously, it's based on the book by Robert Louis Stevenson. It's directed by John S. Robertson, and the writing credits include Robert Louis Stevenson as the book, Clara S. Berenger as scenario, she wrote. also on IMDb, it's funny, IMDb actually lists Oscar Wilde and his novel Picture of Dorian Gray as an inspiration, which there's definitely part of that to this film that doesn't exist in other things. And then also Thomas Russell Sullivan, who wrote a play in 1887, the year after the book came out. And we talked about this in the 31 March episode, right, David, that a lot of what we associate with Jekyll and Hyde, the Jekyll and Hyde story, the large, you know, the one we... The overall thing we're more familiar with, a lot of it comes out of this play by T.R. Mm-hmm. Sullivan, like the fiance character. There's no female love interest for Dr. Jekyll in the Robert Louis Stevenson book. That's an invention of the play. So, yeah. And that's sort of inspired thing, which you can understand for the films, they were like, well, you know, it'd be better if Henry Jekyll had it. And we'll get into the film in a minute, but it, you know, it gives him stakes, right? It gives him something to lose, obviously, loses himself to Mr. Hyde, right? So it makes sense. It's good. It's good drama.
Yeah, absolutely. I was re-listening to, I didn't get all the way through the Christopher Lee audiobook on YouTube that's free. But yeah.
Whoa, there's a, oh.
Yeah, it's good.
Gotta listen to that. Yeah, that's cool.
It's excellent. He does it, you know, as you can imagine. But it really is like those three men, essentially, in the book, in the novella. It's like,
yes,
Jekyll, you got Utterson, you got Lanyon, and they're old friends. And actually, I was struck by this time that I don't think I ever really registered it, but Hyde. Jekyll is in his 50s in the text.
Yes, he's older.
Yeah, describe Hyde as like this younger man. But yeah, so it's a lot about the three of them, and then the kind of narratives are, it unfolds in more of a mystery and these kind of limited point of view things, kind of Rashomon-esque.
Kind of flashbacks almost. Yeah, Rashomon. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, things from different perspectives.
But I think that play
the book
really
is kind of complicated. The novella, I should say. Yes.
Yeah, it can be a little I mean, it's not hard to track, but if you're used to seeing it unfold in a more kind of straightforward and sequential way, like these movies portray, then it's, you kind of have to find your place in it. But yeah, there's no women. Exactly. I don't even know. I don't even think there's like prostitutes or anything in the book. I could be wrong about that part.
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah,
but
yeah.
But in any event, yeah, that 1887 play that I meant to look up the actor's name. I think of him best as Benson, but he played Poole in the 31 film and also on that stage play, I believe.
Yes.
But yeah, so that's one of the early, if not earliest, adaptation on film for it. I'm trying to remember.
There's apparently a silent film. There's apparently a snippet of a silent film that happened before this. It's like 1916.
That was Murnau's film?
I don't know if it is. I don't think that one exists.
Right. No, it didn't survive.
And then there was a parallel 1920s version, another version of this that I've watched a bit of, and there's a reason people say it's the inferior version. It's the inferior version.
It's not true.
I think it might insult high school play actors to compare to a high school play. Like it's pretty broad. It's pretty, yeah, it's fine. But that one actually does still exist, so good for that. So this one, again, the Paramount version stars John Barrymore as Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. He was a very, very famous stage actor, maybe one of the most famous stage actors of the time. And this film was actually shot in the day, and they shot it in New York City so that he could perform on Broadway at night. So he's doing this during the day, and then he's performing on stage at night because he was that much sought in demand. In addition to his wide thespian career, our fans of our type of movie will know him from The Invisible Woman, unfortunately. he was in Svengali, and he was in Rasputin and the Empress, which is a cool movie, by the way, if anybody wants to check that one out. As George Carew, we have Brandon Hurst. Brandon Hurst is a big-time horror guy. He was in The Hunchback 23 with Lon Chaney. He was in Murders of the Rue Morgue. He's in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and he's in Ghost of Frankenstein and White Zombie, mostly in small parts in the Frankenstein movies. Millicent Carew is played by Martha Mansfield. She was in The Silent Command with Lugosi, and she died on stage at age 24 when her dress caught fire.
Oh, no.
On set. She was on the set of a film and her dress caught on fire. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Geez. An unfortunately very short career for this actress. Charles Lane plays Dr. Lanyon. Cecil Clovelly plays Edward Einfield. Newcomer Nita Naldi plays Miss Gina. And George Stevens plays Poole. Dr. Jekyll's loyal butler, who's always a main character in these movies. It's funny. Poole is always like, he's sort of proto-Alfred, you know, like to Bruce Wayne. Yeah. I always think about that. He's basically the very stiff, erect, like proper, you know, guy. And he's not, you know, quite sure what's happening.
That's great.
Although Alfred's in on the whole thing that Bruce Wayne is, spoilers, bad man. so it's not a, just in case there's someone who, I don't know. I hate to be that guy.
No. I've had things ruined by not yours, but a podcast before, and it was devastating. Yeah. So it's good to look it up.
We will be ruining lots of stuff, just in case you're somehow not familiar with the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know, in general. And also, if you're not familiar with this film, we will be talking going back and forth all throughout it, discussing its ins and outs. It begins with a quote, which reads, "In each of us, two natures are at war, the good and the evil. All our lives, the fight goes on between them, and one of them must conquer. But in our own hands lies the power to choose. What we want to be most, we are. The central moral lesson of the story is the responsibility for every decision we make, good or bad, and the ramifications of those decisions. The autonomy I'm riffing now. I'm saying,
oh, this is a different version.
that goes on. My point is that you know, I think the overall thesis of the movie is that we have the option to go either way. We have this free will to be good people or bad people, and it's, to me, it's about that. It's not just that you're either good or bad. It's your deeds and how, you know, the things you do are on the trail to either one way or the other, and it's up to us to decide. The allegory of Stevenson's story is that in order to indulge in the things he wants to do that Dr. Jekyll knows he shouldn't do, he actually finds a way to become a whole other person and do these things with impunity. He finds a cheat, right?
Yeah.
Because in his real life, Henry Jekyll is, and we are introduced to him as he's a scientist and philanthropist. He's a wealthy man. Poor people really did not often become doctors back then. It's not like you could get a scholarship to a college and get your degree and stuff. I'm not sure in 1880s if I do think you still had to have some kind of degree to practice medicine, hopefully in some way, shape, or form. Yeah. It's not like the Middle Ages, right? Where you went to the barber, right? And he bled you, I think, with leeches. Dr. Jekyll is a well-to-do person who spends his time sort of split between doing research into the nature of, you know, chemistry and the human body and everything, and also donating his time working in a clinic where he helps poor people who have all sorts of various ailments and stuff like that. It's this, you know, it's this portrait of this very saint-like Dr. Jekyll. And I think the setup here is that we're supposed to think Dr. Jekyll is just such altogether a good guy. But here's the, well, he's got a couple problems. One of them is that he likes this girl named Millicent Carew. And the problem is his work keeps him very busy and he's sort of ignoring her, and she's getting a little impatient and a little curious as to whether or not he's serious about their, does it specify, David? It's they're not actually engaged, right? He's trying to court her, I guess.
I get a little confused sometimes because the storyline is so similar between the three main that are so well known, to where I don't know that they are engaged, but it's, I think that, so that they do this great thing with the title cards about introducing the people as you've been sharing.
Yes.
It's like they show the person, they say like one line about them, and then they say who the actor is on the title card.
The actor is playing him. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And then the one for Millicent's father, for Sir George Carew, played by Brandon Hirst, they say, always as far from misery and suffering as he could get. And they paint him out in this version to be like a very worldly man who very actively tempts Jekyll. And so it's sort of interesting the way that that's set up, because in the Frederick March version that we talked about last time from 31, Carew is much more, he's so much more conservative to where he, like, he wants, Muriel is his daughter's name, and it's like the Millicent character, and mm-hmm. he wants them to be proper and to get married when on like his wife's anniversary or something like that. Where
yes, he, exactly.
Here it's
he's
kind
controlling,
of
controlling, but
yeah, different dynamic to where this guy's. I mean, he wants to protect his daughter, I guess, from the evils of the world, in some ways by like marrying her to this like very noble man. So I don't know if he's like testing him. I don't get the sense. I get the sense he's tempting him more than testing him. It's weird.
Yes, I think so, and I think that's where the influence of the picture of Dorian Gray, the Oscar Wilde kind of thing, comes in. You know, he's George Carew, Millicent's father. Something I was reading lists him as he's a successful cad. He's kind of a libertine. He's a guy who's like sowed his wild oats. He's gone out there and he's like hung out with girls and he's done a whole bunch of stuff. And it does seem like he sort of wants to protect Millicent from that world mm-hmm. that he is, but he's unapologetically like that. He's like a lech. I mean, mm-hmm. he's really yeah. like, you know, he's a dirty old man. Really.
That's right. That's a great way.
And he seems intent from the beginning on bringing Jekyll, who's very reserved and kind of lives in his head. And, you know, he's not worldly in the way that Carew thinks men should be worldly, going to taverns, brothels, and things like that. And I think Carew represents a type of idea in Victorian, especially maybe British culture, that gentlemen behave in a proper way, right? When around proper company, but uh-huh. there are allowances that they can go certain places and behave in a completely different way. And for some reason, that's okay for them. It's not okay for poor people to behave that way, but it's somehow okay for men of means to do this. This is their out, right? It's a rationalization of some kind that I'm sure other people have written more about and can discuss more intelligently than I, not being, you know, being a guy from Pittsburgh yeah. in the 1980s. I don't know. When Henry finally does get to, in the beginning, I skipped over, he's doing some research and his friend Lanyon is there, who's a slightly older man and he's much more conservative he's conservative, intellectually, I guess, or he's maybe more religious than Henry. They're having an ethical argument over the role of science to better mankind. And Lanyon sort of represents the whole, like, things we were not meant to mess with argument, kind of very mm-hmm. much like the Frankenstein argument we see where Henry's starting to sort of try to find ways to reprogram the human body, you know, what we would now think of as like stem cell research or something like that. Like Henry, you know, Henry's a brilliant scientist and he's way ahead of everybody else in this type of research that he's doing. And Lanyon, of course, is trying to be the voice of reason, being like, yeah, don't mess with things that aren't meant to be messed with. But Henry will ignore him to his own yeah. detriment, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. They set up the character so well with those like title cards and stuff. Like within the first, I don't know, 3 minutes or something, you know who everyone is and what their situation is and literally the thesis of the movie. It's like really economical.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I just saw the title card where Lanyon's like, stick to the positive sciences, Jekyll, whichever. I don't know what that means. the film is staged much more like a play. It's very much staged on a proscenium. The camera is pretty much always facing like one direction. It never turns around and never, because it's shot on these basically the way now a sitcom is shot, if anybody has seen that, where there's sort of the aisle where the cameras go, and then there are rows of sets that have three walls side by side by side by side, and the cameras just move up and down and stuff. This is really how they used to shoot a lot of silent film. And this was shot on the rooftop studio of a big theater in New York City too, which some of it was. I think the pit with the carriages and stuff is on the ground level, and I don't know where that was shot, but yeah.
That's cool.
I don't know if we've talked about a movie that was shot in New York City before. We've talked about movies that were shot in Germany and France and whatnot, but yeah. Anyway, Jekyll shows up late. Millicent's happy to see him, but he immediately, you know, they have dinner, but he immediately kind of does that thing where after dinner, the men sit around to smoke, and the women sit around and play the harpsichord or so, and yeah. you know, do womanly things, whatever. And this is where Carew, I think the interesting thing, Carew doesn't understand Henry's selflessness. Mm-hmm. I think he wants to trust Henry, you know, to be courting his daughter, and I don't think he because he's so kind of morally bereft. I don't think he trusts that there's not some other side to Henry. I think what you're saying is right, that he's kind of trying to tempt him to see, like that Henry doesn't comport to what Sir George thinks a man is like.
Right, yeah.
Because he's a different type. You know, George thinks like, yeah, okay, you have the daughter, you take care of your kid and everything like that. But then you also go out and whore around too. That's what men do, you know. And Henry's not into that really, mostly. And so George like thinks there's something up with him that you know, he wants he wants to take him out, which he does. He takes Henry and everybody out after this party to go carouse around with the men and, you know, smoke cigars and watch a girl dance in slightly less clothing than the average Victorian woman wears. She's still wearing quite a bit of clothing, but you know, hey, for modern takes. Yeah. And he comes at Henry with this line that again, that we talk about the sins of Dorian Gray, but it also reminds me of, we were just mentioning Rasputin, and it's this, a man cannot destroy the savage in him by denying his impulses. The only way to get rid of temptation is to yield to it, which was, David, like, you know, like that was Rasputin's thing too. It was like, well, if we want to be forgiven by God, we have to confess. And if we have to confess, we need to do things to confess to, right? So that was Rasputin's rationale to have like orgies and crap in St. Petersburg or Moscow or wherever he was. Yeah, that was his rationale. And again, it is this sort of Faustian thing too, right? There's this, it's like Sir George is sort of the little devil on Henry's shoulder, nudging him. And without him in this version of the story, at least, I don't think we get Henry indulging in his experiments, and we don't have Mr. Hyde and we don't have the story. So he's a bit of a vehicle.
He's like the antagonist kind of, because it's a weird movie story in where the hero is the villain.
It is, right?
Depending on the scene. Yeah.
Yes.
So this gives an external force, I guess, to kind of react to.
Yes. So they take him out to the dance hall where we meet Miss Gina, who's played by Nita Naldi, and she's performing on stage. And yeah, it's like a lowbrow place. It's a place where, like, you know, working class folks go and they get blitzed out drunk on bad gin or what have you. And you know, it's a prurient enjoyments in this place. Much, much different from the very refined kind of world that they were just at in the dinner. I'm fascinated with Cecil Clovelly's old age makeup in this. Did you notice this? Where the one guy's he's made up like ridiculously old, like he's not an older actor, and he's made up to look
so weird,
quite old. And it's really like for a movie with his makeup as good as this makeup is for Dr. Jekyll and Hyde. Cecil's makeup is kind of he's playing Edward Einfield, who is a more critical character in the book than this. He's sort of relegated to kind of second class status here.
And ironically, I could be getting this wrong, but I think in the book he's actually younger than the other guys. So it's weird that they
I think you're right.
Wanted to make him up to be as old as them, but it seems like they went far the other way. It's a distracting makeup. It's almost as intense as Mr. Hyde.
I don't know if you're familiar with Zachary, the horror host, but to me, like he looks exactly like Zachary. Like, they just frosted his hair, or he might be wearing a wig, and then he's got this like stippled something on his face where it made him look weathered and everything. It's just such a,
it's kind of comical.
It is. It's funny. It's almost like he's a character in disguise. The owner of the tavern sends Miss Gina over to Sir George. And the idea is that I think she is it's like, if you've seen Moulin Rouge, the Baz Luhrmann version, she's a dancer and she's also a prostitute. And I think those two things just kind of go hand in hand for this type of establishment.
I love the way they put it in the title. Like, the title cards are interestingly poetic, I think. They're always very brief and they say a lot with few words. So when they introduce her and the actress, kind of her introductory card, they just say Gina, who faced her world alone. Sort of tells you all you need to know between that and the visual.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think she's the actress, I think, was Italian. And I don't know if she did a whole lot of stuff. I neglected to research her too well on this, but she's, she, I mean, she, she's sort of sent straight. I think the idea is that Sir George has set it up with Einfield that they're going to hook Jekyll up with her, because she goes right to him and she just grabs him and hugs him. And I got to say, Sir George is watching this and he seems to be enjoying it quite a bit.
Yes, he does like to watch.
He seems to be enjoying spectating quite a bit. And maybe that has something to do with his motivations. I don't know. I don't judge. I'm just saying. He maybe is a little too old for this kind of thing, so he just likes to watch. I don't know. Yeah. It's okay.
When you get like Barrymore's unblinking intensity, like he's just...
Yes.
He's so intense with his eyes. Like they're so...
Very much so.
...wide, and you got that iconic profile that they... They really lean on, but...
He does a lot of scenes, of shots in profile. Yeah, and I think he... Because his profile was very famous. It was his sort of... it's what he was known for. And he was... I think there were probably photos of him that people collected. He was just... You know, he's quite famous for that. So, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking that too, David, while I was watching this. It's like, I've never seen him... I don't know if I've ever seen a movie where the main character... spend so much time, we're only seeing half of his face.
Yeah. It's an appropriate thing for this. They maybe make more use of that, even the whole, like, just half of the face thing.
Right. No, it's neat. Jekyll resists temptation. He doesn't want anything to do with this, with, you know, this kind of world. But it sets him on a thing. And so here's the what we call the inciting incident in writing. He's going to go home and he's going to work on a way to become someone who could do these kinds of things. Because obviously, I mean, he's tempted. It's not like he's repulsed by her or anything like that. But Jekyll lives in a world of like a class society, first of all. That he believes, obviously we're seeing it different because we're seeing the way Sir George behaves and stuff, but he believes that some of the things he wants are not acceptable, but he still wants them. So he has to find a way in this version of it to be able to do those things that he wants to do, namely hook up with women of questionable moral character. I mean, the movie, and this is something I'll get into towards at some point, but this is something that Stevenson did not approve of in the play version that alluded to this, because a lot of this is more from the play than it is from the book. He's even quoted as saying, I will read the quote here. It's a subquote. It's from a YouTube channel called Grunge HQ, by the way. I want to credit it. I want to do my research. Stevenson's overarching critique of Victorian society lies in his assertion of that era's morality. That era's morality, marked by suppression of natural human impulses and hiding the undesirable, was utterly destructive to both individuals and society at large. So Robert Louis Stevenson's kind of, I think, idea for the character is that... Hyde was just a version of Jekyll that he tried to sort of show the lack of inhibition, because Jekyll's just all about being inhibited by what he believes is right and proper. And this sexualization of the story is something that came afterwards.
Oh.
And apparently Stevenson thought that was sort of kind of aside from the point or not, you know, whatever, not to get too deep into the whole thing, everybody, but yeah. But it is, cause I want to discuss it just because it is the central basis of this story. Jekyll's frustration and the reason he wants to turn into Hyde is really based on the conservative sexuality of the era and of his class within this era. And it's really, and that's why I say at the beginning, like Hyde doesn't really, and we'll get to like Hyde does one really bad thing in this movie, and then except for that, he really just goofs around a little bit.
Yeah,
and that's me that lowers the drama of the story, and I'll kind of get to that as we get towards the end when I get to more my thesis of it thing. But yeah, it's really about frustrated sexuality in a repressive culture, and Jekyll wants to try some things because he does love Millicent. It seems, you know, he wants to marry her, but he also wants this other thing. So this is his initiative to try to become a second person that can go around and horse around, as mm-hmm. my mom would have said.
yeah. I mean, I can understand perhaps that that's not what the author is going for, but it does seem a good way to further externalize the duality thing. I mean, it's pretty reductive, of course, like just have, you know, the Madonna whore complex thing where you basically have this mm-hmm. one on a pedestal and the other one that's like down in the gutter. But it is interesting when you're juxtaposing that with these two very extreme versions or bifurcation of man, and then this other kind of thing with women. And of course, yeah, actually it'd be interesting to see them do more of that maybe in some sort of modern retelling, because there's a lot more of an interesting tightrope that perhaps a woman, especially a woman of that time, might have had to walk to. I don't know.
I think so. I think it'd be more interesting to see a little more of it from the perspective of the two women, like we do in, I will say, like, I mean, based on basically the same concept, the 31 version takes this whole idea and does it really, really well with the prostitute character in that version and stuff. We really see more of it from her perspective. And seeing it from her perspective, we see how terrifying Hyde is. Also, Hyde, actually, the body count is a little higher. We feel better feeling like Hyde is the villain in this. And in this one, this version, and I don't want to get down on it, I'm not saying I don't like the film. I love this movie too. I think it's just more representative of its era. And the 31 is more, whatever. I haven't seen it's 1940, right? The Spencer Tracy one?
Yeah, maybe even 42, possibly. I'm 42 not super or something
like
sure.
That. I just saw a clip, and I've always been, I've seen it, and I'm kind of like, yeah, you know, okay, you know. I always felt like it was a little bit of a watered down thing as well, but I just saw a clip of it, and I saw Tracy as Hyde, and I was like, I do need to, I don't know if what happened on the podcast, everybody. If we do, David will be my co-host on it, obviously. Awesome, yeah. We should go for the hat trick, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Those are the three ones in terms of like the big adaptations.
Yes.
It's my least favorite as well. This one has the transformations in the 31 are so great, but there's something about this first one that I really love. His kind of like refusal of the call. Like I must have seen this a clip on 80s TV or something. I grew up in Northeast Ohio, like a suburb of Cleveland, and I don't know, it just seemed like these things were always playing on an early Fox network or WUAB we had out there, but somehow
one of your local channels, right?
Yeah, somehow I saw this clip before I saw anything else of him. Like, he has the potion, you know, he's like standing back. He's like, "No, I'm not going to take it." And then is like, what's the antagonist guy? I'm blanking on his name. Carew. He kind of comes up superimposed, like even kind of squished to fit him right in between the empty space between the table and Jekyll, like visually taunting him. And then he eventually marches in and drinks it. And it, you know, I guess it's a nod to that play again, the Richard Mansfield, I want to say, was the lead actor who would do the transformation without any makeup or anything like that, and just kind of through the pantomime and I think some lighting. Right. And Barrymore does it an incredible version of
Mansfield. Mansfield was very famous. Mansfield was the actor who played Jekyll and Hyde in the play version and was really well known for it. And I don't know if he was up for playing it in this film version or Barrymore beat him out or anything like that. But he was known for that. And we're going to see this in a minute. We're going to get more into like the meat and potatoes of this movie here, guys, because we're going to get into the Hyde stuff, which I'm anxious to talk about. The transformation, it's not done technically as elaborately, obviously, as the 31 Raoul Walsh version was. And we don't see it's not a lot, you know, from the POV or anything like that. But it's excellently done in a minimal way. And the makeup is, David, I don't know if you found anything out about the makeup. I reached out a lifeline to like Frank Dietz and he tried to refer to me to someone and I haven't had a chance to hear back from him. I have no idea who did the makeup in this movie. I don't know if Barrymore did some of his own makeup or if someone else did it.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing, and obviously everybody feel free to send some links or comments on the Facebook and Instagram post when we you know start talking about this film when it comes out in a few days. Jekyll takes the potion, and this first stage of it is really like you're saying, David. It's just him moving around and shaking his hair and doing some stuff. I think they might do a little bit of this lighting change thing that they do so well in the March version, where I think some of his makeup is done in a certain color and they have the same color light on him, and then they switch up the light and stuff. But mostly, I think it's Barrymore contorting this first stage here. We see it's Barrymore contorting his face. It's Barrymore really making a weird face, but to a point where it's really like Barrymore, for being such a handsome man, is able to make himself grotesque looking.
Oh yeah. That face is, I'm not allowed to do that face around the house. My wife won't have it. She finds it too creepy.
Yeah, no, no face. Right. And then we slowly start adding some prosthetics. I think he gets a false jaw attitude that builds up his jaw and gives it like a more, you know, we talked about March's version of the hide makeup in the March version being a much more Neanderthal-ish. You know, the idea of this regression of what the era would have called a finely proportioned man's face into something hideous and ancient. And it works, and I love that makeup, and I really do love that makeup. This actually might be my favorite Hyde makeup, though.
I might go with that, too. It's great.
It's revolting. It's incredibly... It looks like he's another species of animal than a human. You know, there's just something incredible about it. And also, you know, it's his physical thing. We're kind of used to Hyde, I think starting in the 31 version, and then this version goes all the way through, especially through Abbott and Costello Meet. You did Abbott and Costello Meet Jekyll and Hyde with me as well, didn't you, David?
Oh, no, I did another one, Meet the Killer, Boris Karloff.
You did Meet the Killer. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Sorry, that was Scott did whatever. Darn, I thought you'd already, you know,
actually, amazing.
You know, closed the circuit. Yeah. But we have this idea of this acrobatic Hyde that can jump and climb fences and stuff like that. And I think that's become a conceit of a lot of the film versions, because, you know, the more reserved Jekyll is one thing, but like the idea of a Hyde that can climb up on the rooftops of London and swing around chimneys and all that fun stuff is really cool. But this version, the makeup gets more extreme as the more time he spends as Hyde. So Hyde starts out looking not great, but by the end he's revolting. He's covered in like sores and stuff. He's walking with a cane, like his body's, it's like the evil inside him is corrupting his body. Right. Like, and he's getting more and more twisted. It's such a great, this literally might be my favorite Hyde makeup. This is so, it's really scary. It's actually for a silent film, it's scary.
Yeah, that's the scene that we'll get to much later. Like, the one time he does do something truly horrible in this movie is still to this day really terrifying to me.
Yes.
Because of his expression and because of the makeup and the culmination of it all. But he's like absolutely hunched. He's almost like, he's like less physically agile and more feeble. But he's got these crazy like tree trunk fingers and gnarled fingernails that give his hands this gigantic, I don't know.
Absolutely.
Like, he's just unsettling to look at. Whereas there's no, fun about him to me. Like, it's just
right.
For as menacing as Frederick March has became, especially with the sort of domestic abuse situation with Ivy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. There's just a malevolence to this guy just from, I don't know, just his the way that he carries himself and the expression on his face. It's chilling.
He almost seems demonic. I mean, there actually seems like something. Yeah, exactly. And there's this thing that gets bigger and bigger on the back of his head as he as he progresses, that ends up his hair falls out and he's got this giant conical protrusion from the back of his head that's bald and just like, and he really just starts looking like, obviously everyone, if you've seen the movie, you know what we're all talking about and we're just going on about it. But it is in a movie that I will say is you know, has its good sides and less maybe good sides. The one of the standout things is March's amazing portrayal of Hyde and then the makeup that assists him to it. Cause that's really what Hyde is, you know, Hyde is an actor's dream. It's the ability to just do this incredible performance. And hopefully with the assistance of great makeup, then, you know, you get the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. I was stupid, but I like his robe. I love the smoke.
His robe's really...
In the earliness of it, it kind of puts it that much closer to the source material. So I know it's not like a documentary, but there's something about this one that feels old. I mean, it is the oldest, but it's like, I don't know. It's sort of, it's almost like it feels like it's lit by candlelight or something. I don't know.
It's less than 40 years after the source material was written. Yeah. It's pretty close on. I like his smoking jacket. He spends a lot of time in. It's like there's this competition between the Invisible Man and Dr. Jekyll as to who has the cooler smoking jackets. They're both very much known for their smoking jackets. And I think there was definitely like something in there for the ladies in the audience as well, is that Barrymore plays a lot of the film with his collar open, uh-huh. You know, and just a little bit of his chest peeking out and stuff. And, you know, I think there was an intentional titillation thing going on there for some members of the audience, women and possibly men too. Hey.
They did just do, I was watching and he does do, when he looks at himself in the mirror, he does fully turn to a profile. Cause I didn't think they did it as Hyde, but
Right. But it's great as Hyde. Cause then you see this, like his, like, that's my thing is, and I'll move on everybody, but you know, the March makeup is really great and it does change so much of March's obviously very handsome, you know, face. The Barrymore makeup, it changes the shape of his body. I mean, it changes the shape of his head. It changes, I mean, he's literally like it's one of those amazing makeups where so often when you have makeup, obviously makeup has to go on top of your existing form. And so the trick with many, you know, actual practical applications of makeup is to not build up a character too much and make them thick or, you know, husky. And I think maybe the best example of like how not to do that, I'm sorry, would be the James Cagney Man of a Thousand Faces when they made him up as the Phantom of the Opera. And he just looks like he's wearing makeup, but he looks like he's just wearing a rubber mask. His head's round and thick and looks like Charlie Brown or something like that. It's just, I'm sorry, it's an awful friggin' makeup. It's just terrible, especially because you have it to compare to next side by side with Lon Chaney's incredible makeup where he managed to take his face and make it look skull-like. It looked like he was subtracting from the size of his head, which is obviously impossible. You can't do that. So there's other ways you do that. And this makeup succeeds for a very, very early 1920, very early makeup. This succeeds amazingly at carving out Barrymore's features as opposed to building on top of them. Anyway, magical. I would love to learn a bunch more about its application and how long it took and what the thinking was and what it was based on and stuff. So if anybody knows any of that, which I'd be willing to bet some of our listeners are going to be able to school me in that and will happily do so. So there we go. He tells once now he's back to whatever Jekyll, he tells his servant Poole that he's going to have this guy named Hyde, coming and going. And he wants him to have free reign of the property. So that he could start doing this. So again, like this is Jekyll's evil plan. I mean, like we, you know, I think we're sort of led to think that Jekyll is a good character and Hyde is a bad character in the way we the way pop culture kind of looks at this movie. But really, I mean, Jekyll's the villain because Jekyll does this. This doesn't just happen to Jekyll. It's not an accident. Especially in this version, he's intentionally doing this. So, okay, you know, anything bad that happens, it's on Jekyll's head. It's not, you know, he's not, obviously there's a parallel to addiction and substance abuse and the idea that Hyde, just like an addiction, gradually starts taking over and doing things that Jekyll, you know, Jekyll's starting to not have his hand on the wheel, but still.
Yeah. I always found that interesting. I mean, not always, but as I've gotten older, found the alcohol addiction thing kind of interesting. And then it's a drink that he takes. I think in the novella, is some powder involved or something like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess...
That's the thing that he loses. And in this version too, he loses access to. So there's this, it's this one ingredient that was a mistake, and that's how it successfully happens.
Okay. Yeah. But I love with the alcohol. Well, I love with the alcohol. There's an anecdote that I like that I want to say might have been on like Greg Mink's commentary for the 31 film, where he talks about a story. I don't know where he heard it, but that one of Barrymore's wives wanted to see him do his Hyde impression so badly that even though he was an alcoholic, she's like, I'll give you a beer if you do the impression. Because so much of it is just his physicality. And so I guess he did, and it scared her and all that. But and then,
oh, really? Jeez, that's cool.
And then the other one I heard is that he did it to get like $1,000 knocked off the price of a house for a realtor.
That's on IMDb or something like that. Yeah, I read that anecdote too. Like, okay, wow, nice. Performing for your money. The sort of odd and kind of sad parallel of the story is that Barrymore himself, did have an alcohol abuse problem. I want to say it was maybe more under control at this stage of his career, but it progressively led to the point where, you know, he's doing the invisible girl. Okay. You know, like the invisible woman, you know, I mean, his substance abuse problem almost pretty much derailed his career. And his brother Lionel, who was less famous than him at this stage, ends up, at least in the film world, kind of eclipsing him to the point where he's so recognizable in so many movies, including Devil Doll and that's Lionel Barrymore in It's a Wonderful Life, right?
Oh, now I'm just the old man Potter. Devil Doll, but that sounds right. Sure. Yeah.
I can't remember. Anyway.
To look that up.
We have a next, his next steps, Jekyll's going to put his kind of Hyde plan into motion. As Hyde, he goes and he rents a room somewhere else in town so he can lead like the second life. And he rents from this like awesome looking old landlady. And there, you know, I do like this idea that Hyde runs around and he's got access to Jekyll's bank account and his billfold and you know notes or whatever we were using for money at this point. He pulls out these big notes. So you know he's this corrupted little creature that for some reason like can suddenly throw around a whole bunch of money. And they do this in the 31 thing where he orders champagne and all that, you know. So he rents this room from which he's gonna, you know, do his thing. And then we have a title card that says, "In the impenetrable mask of another identity, Hyde set forth upon a sea of license to do what he, as Jekyll, could not do," which is, you know, go hang out with Miss Gina. And the implication is that he woos her and then puts her up in this room with him, which is similar to the 31 version. And they sort of have this, like, awful domestic situation together. They're living in sin. You know, he doesn't marry her or anything like that. He has her in a room and I think he's paying her enough to take care of her. And then he's using her for his needs.
Mm-hmm.
So there we go. And then eventually we see him, he just kicks her out. Like he gets tired of her and he throws her aside. He does not kill her in the way that March does in the 31 version. So, but as he's meeting her, so this is this important kind of secondary plot. he's sitting in the bar with her, and she has a ring on, and we know her character's from Italy because it's a poison ring, and then it does this whole flashback to Italy where a guy uses a ring given to him, a poison pill given to him that was hidden in this ring. He gives it to a guy who's trying to seduce the woman that he wants. And I don't know if anyone's seen the Borgia series on cable. It was on like a decade or so ago. But this is kind of a common way of dealing with people in Italy from a certain era, to the point where the Pope at the time would actually, they constantly poisoned people. They would get people to sign over like a will to like the church for their property, and then they would kill them, basically. Oh. It was kind of a brother and sister, I think, that did this. And to the point where, like, when people started, whenever in a certain era people would poison people, they were called a Borgia. Their name sort of became, it's like aspirin, right? I mean, their name became synonymous with whatever like that. But it was at least perceived to be a very popular way for Italian people to kill people. So he takes the ring, and then the ring with the poison pill is going to factor in importantly, you know, later on. Does the David, does the version you're watching, is it so I when I made my notes, I was just watching a version of this on YouTube, and then I have a DVD. I've loaned those like cheapo DVDs that's like you know, that you bought at Half Price Books back in the day.
Oh yeah,
I don't have a really good version of this. And I like this version is all black and white. The version I was watching on YouTube has the thing where like the night scenes are tinted blue, and then that Italian scene is tinted pink for some reason. It's the Mediterranean, I guess. Yeah.
I have the one I'm watching is the Kino. They've done a Blu-ray up-res, or a better transfer probably. I just have the DVD, but it is tinted. And actually, this was the first silent movie I ever saw tinted. I remember like getting a Laserdisc player from like the larger library in a neighboring town and like renting the player.
That's cool.
And the Laserdisc of this. And
nice.
Having to
the player and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah. I used to do this. I looked old for my age, and so I was able to get away with this. And I remember like my senior year of high school, I wanted to bring it to school, and I was not yet 18, and they're like, "We had no idea you were 18. You can't have any of this."
Oh, that's hilarious.
But so I was blown away the first time I saw it by this. I'm like, "What is this tinting thing?" Like I kind of, and there wasn't much internet, you just kind of put it together like, "Oh, that must be nighttime," or you kind of figured it
out. Right. But, it was an attempt to do it. And you see different versions of different films that have that and don't have that. I personally, I'll just go on record saying I hate it. I hate the tinting. I can understand that something's supposed to be night. I don't need everything to be like blue, because the way they would do it, it's a layer of something on top of it, so it darkens everything. Mm. And you lose so much resolution usually in the process and stuff. It's okay. I'm surprised because I have the nice version. I think it's the Kino version of Nosferatu, and it's got all the tinting on it. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, these films are so old. Everybody, this film is 104 years old that we're talking about right now, right?
Wow.
Definitely the oldest film we talked about. So let's just all be thankful that these films still exist when so many silent films don't exist anymore. So many silent films were lost or destroyed or just thrown away and burned, reused, whatever. It's like all this amazing, Twilight Zone, or maybe all the early, like Studio 50, whatever, TV shows that they just taped over. they ran out of tape, but we've lost so many like great, like Rod Serling stories and stuff because of that. Cause they were like, "Whoa, whatever, who cares?" In Jekyll's absence, while he's out cavorting as Hyde, his friend Utterson proposes to Millicent. So he's obviously, you know, he has his own agenda. She's holding out for Henry. So it's awkward. It's really, I like this scene because it's really awkward.
Yeah.
It's like, he's like, there's somebody else, and she almost won't even tell him. She just stares at him weirdly.
It seemed to come out of nowhere.
I don't think he handled it very well. It's amazing seeing Martha Mansfield here, and she's so interesting looking, and it's sad to think that in just a few years she'd be gone. So wow. Henry signs a will that names Hyde as the beneficiary in case I think it's in case he's stuck in the form somehow and he can't get out of it. And he has Utterson. I think Utterson is some kind of lawyer or notary or something, and he's doing it for him. And no one understands why he's doing this. And this is something that's a straight lift from the book, where that's the thing that almost incites everybody being concerned about Jekyll, because he signed his estate and everything, his wealth, to this Edward Hyde, people who has been seen on the street of London, like kicking a kid and stuff. Like everyone knows, like, this guy's like not a good dude, and everyone worries about what's on Henry Jekyll's mind that he's doing this. So this is a nice, like, total lift from the story. It's almost like, I guess, Jekyll's had some fun and now he's thinking, okay, maybe I need to get back to, you know, the important things that should be a priority. So he tries to reconnect with Millicent, and he forgoes turning into Hyde for a while. He tries to go straight, right?
Yeah, yeah. Tries to quit cold turkey.
Yes. But eventually it's gonna whatever. So
I like it says that, yeah. In a sudden revulsion against the power he felt was dragging him down, Dr. Jekyll gave a hostage to his soul. That's yes, how they sort yes. of transition out of that. It's weird because he is making this choice to not be Hyde anymore, but the way that they phrase that, you know, it's short lived and gives extra tension to it.
Yeah, he's got to go visit his Italian sweetie, I think. But he does, and he basically puts her hat on her head and is like, get out. Like, oh, we're done.
So, yeah, just unceremoniously dismissed.
He says, I'm through with you. Oh, jeez. Yeah. And poor Miss Gina, she's a very sad character. Here we see he has started to walk with a cane now. And he started to wear this it's a kind of a bowler, but it's this extended bowler hat, like derby hat, and it has to be extended because he's obviously started to grow this much bigger protuberance on the back of his head, which we haven't really seen yet. But he's more hunched, he's more his clothes are filthy too, which is interesting. Like, it's almost like Jekyll has a set of clothes he changes into when he becomes Hyde. That, you know,
yeah, they like
it's like, okay, I'll wear the shitty clothes,
roll them in dirt and stuff. Like, they're literally caked in like grime,
right? Right. So when he does finally, you know, turn back into going into Hyde. The one thing is, like, I just came up and I wanted to like he's going straight, right? And he's trying to woo Millicent or something like that. But I think something's changed in Henry too, right? He's kind of, he looks like it's like Hyde's gotten into him a little bit.
Yeah,
the makeup on Barrymore is starting to look. It's not that his makeup from the beginning of the film. He's got heavier color around his eyes and heavier brows and stuff. It's like he turns back into Jekyll, but he doesn't. It's like 98% Jekyll now, right?
Yeah, you can see some darkness creeping. And they do this thing with the title cards that, like that one I was mentioning about. Giving a hostage to his soul. They did it with the marriage thing too, where they just do like a proposal of marriage. But the way that they cut it and juxtapose those things, I remember, or watching it this time with the marriage, I thought maybe it was going to be Hyde marrying Gina or something. Yes. But it then turns out to be, you know, the failed proposal of Utterson. But so when the hostage to his soul, I actually think they're playing a double meaning with like Gina and because the scene then that follows that is him now kind of no longer the pure man that he was at the beginning of the film. The hostage, I think, is Millicent. Like, when he essentially then kind of, I don't know if he proposes to her in this scene exactly, but he definitely kind of recommits to her. Anyway, I don't know. It's sort of interesting the way they play with that, or at least my perception of it.
One thing I think is very cool about the way that they do this movie is that there's actually very few inner title cards. Mm-hmm. Compared to a lot of films. And very few of them are direct quotes of what the character is saying. Most of the drama of the story is done through pantomime,
yeah,
of the characters, and sometimes their mouths are moving and they're saying things, but very rarely do we have that translated into text in the intertitles. The intertitles are mostly there to sort of get us to the next, or explain the scene, or get us into the next. They're like an ellipses that bridges one scene into the next. They help tell the story quite a bit, but it's not like a lot of sound moves where someone, their mouth moves and then we stop. And now we have a whole, we have to read what they said, and then it cuts back and the other person's mouth moves, and it, you know, which can get, it can get tiresome. I understand, even for a silent film fan. The way the story, and you and I were talking about this so much in, we were talking about Vampyr, the way the story is told just as a visual, silent, you know, poem, bit of visual poetry, right, is really nice. Like, you know, just, it's just dramatized.
Yeah. And I still, even for as much as I love these movies and stuff, there are times where I think of watching a silent movie, even one that I'm familiar with, as being like this chore or it's going to be boring. But like, yeah, kind of felt like that with this. Even as excited as I was to do it, I was like, okay, I got to make sure, don't be sleepy. All this. And I put it on and I'm shocked at how it's like 80 minutes or whatever. But I don't know. For me, it really does like, it kind of moves quickly. And
it rips.
And,
yeah, I agree.
It's really effective to this day.
I think so too. It's an evocative piece of filmmaking, and it's visually very well told. It's beautiful. It doesn't, it's not done on these like kind of cheap little sets and stuff. I think they invested nicely into it. Hyde, again, we talk about like, oh, his monstrous cruelties and all this awful stuff. He goes to an opium den and he basically finds these two women. And I think he's trying to, I'm not sure if he's trying to decide which of them he likes more. I'm not sure if he's trying to have a three-way.
Yeah, I know. It seems like that's what they're suggesting in 1920s, you know.
Yeah. There's one that's more with it, and there's one that's obviously much more addicted and in the throes of you know, the drug itself. And it's almost like he, I don't know, for a minute it seems like he's actually showing the one that's less aggrieved, kind of. He shows them in the mirror, and he shows the one who's really addicted. Her face is all hollowed out and stuff like that. I mean, the makeup's really cool and beautiful. That's the other thing, is the makeup's so good in this movie, with the exception of the one old guy character. It looks like it could have been shot recently. It doesn't have that super stagey black eyeline makeup. The men aren't wearing lots of lipstick, you know what I mean? Like it's not, it doesn't have that kind of thing. So the way whoever was shot it understood, because they had to do that in the old days, guys, I've talked about this all the time, where like they had trouble managing the exposure of the cameras versus the lights. They needed very bright lights, but people with pale skin, their faces would kind of blow out. So even men needed a lot of makeup to help define their features and not have them just be kind of blinded out in the footage. So, I eventually Hyde seems to end up hooking up with one of these girls, but I just don't know if that's was his plan or how this ends up working out and stuff like that. And I just don't, again, the thing talking about monstrous cruelties, that he commits and stuff like that. It's just, I don't, aside from just being a kind of moralless person, or just not being constrained by the morals of the culture, you know, I you know, it's not until he runs into the little kid that you see Hyde really do anything that we would consider illegal, you know.
Yeah, it's more just this kind of,
like, he's a bit of a douche, I guess. But yeah. I mean, I don't know.
And yeah, he's just doing the things, living the life that, the parts of life that Henry can't, I guess. That's that idea.
Yes,
they split. But yeah, it's more, it seems more about just like getting high and
having
dalliances with the ladies of the night, as the parlance of their times.
I do think one of the notable differences here is, you know, when he's in this opium den, and he's kind of enjoying messing with these people who are sitting there, you know, in the throes of their addictions and everything like that. So, you know, why Hyde, while Jekyll is so driven to help people in need without any thought of compensation to himself or anything, you know, Hyde's marked by his indifference to other people's suffering. Like, he doesn't care. And in a way, he almost enjoys the fact that they're suffering.
Yeah. Actually, you know, it's in a way what I would imagine if we saw more of what this version of Carew was like, General Carew. Like, it seems like he would be out there doing this kind of thing. Like,
up to this point. Jekyll basically turns him into an awful version of Carew. I mean, that's what he does. Yeah, you're right. You're totally right.
That's sort of interesting, especially as how that character meets his end, I guess. But
yes. Yeah, right. But in a way, it's maybe that's Hyde beats his own evil out of himself. I don't know. I don't know how to whatever. Here we first see him doff his hat, and we see this awful thing that's been growing onto the back of his head, which is just excellent. And again, which progresses the more we see it. Sir George goes with Utterson to Millicent is missing Henry. She's really worried about him because he's back, you know, doing his Hyde thing again. Sir George goes with Utterson to Henry's house to pay him a visit and see what's going on with the dude. They actually catch him coming back as Hyde, you know, after a night's of debauchery and everything. And they witness him. And this is again, the direct lift from the book. This is very true to the novella. They see him, As the kid's walking across the street, he knocks the kid down, and then he steps on him. And for everything I've been saying, here we actually do see the cruelty of Hyde. You see, as opposed to the guy who tries to help little kids, as we saw in the beginning of the movie, you know, Henry's late to that party because he's helping this little tiny kid. Here we have Hyde intentionally, you know, just intentionally hurting a child.
Yeah, it's disturbing, and it's there's some insinuation
which is cut out of the 31, right?
I mean, there's supposedly like a, I don't know if it was a promotional still or something where they filmed, maybe they filmed it or maybe they just took that picture because it's an iconic scene from the book. I don't know, but
from the book, right?
Yeah, they dialed that back there, but here they show it, and it's, you know, it's not as disturbing as the film gets, but it is unsettling, certainly, to see him harm a child.
Yeah. Yes,
but there's that thing, like, too, where he's like, he basically, I mean, why does he pay them money? You know, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is that there might be some darker insinuation or subtext of the kind of thing that maybe they couldn't or wouldn't show, of like, why would, you know, he harms a child and pays their parents to be quiet about it. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. He's bribing them off. Right. Yeah. Right. He's like, just, you know, I'm sorry about this. Here. It ostensibly pays for his medical bill maybe or something, but also it's a payoff. Sir George and Utterson kind of confront him in the street that, hey, you know, what are you doing? You just hurt this kid and stuff. And again, in keeping with the book, Hyde runs back to to Jekyll's lab and gets a check and but he throws everything everywhere, which I love. He's a slob. He gets Jekyll's checkbook and he signs a check for like $100 to pay the kid's debt off, but he signs it Henry Jekyll because, you know, that's his name.
Yeah.
And that's the name on the check. And this is the giveaway moment where Sir George and Utterson are like, you know, they don't make the connection. They don't understand, obviously, that this is Henry that they're dealing with because he's so transformed. But this establishes that there's this connection. Like, why is this guy using Jekyll's checks? And he's like, well, no, this is, I work for him. He's my buddy. And then this is the whole thing. Like in the book, they're like, well, why is Jekyll working with this guy? Like, hang on a second. Something's wrong.
Yeah.
I was going to make an allusion to a current situation. I guess I won't though. Never mind. It's better off keeping it neutral. So they go and they talk to Poole and they find that, they find that Hyde is connected to Jekyll. And this is the point where Jekyll realizes that Hyde is threatening everything he actually cares about. And I have a question here in my notes. I was like, has he even had time to do his clinic thing lately? Like, is he just spending all his time just like hooking up with loose women as Hyde? There's probably like the line is probably out the door of his clinic. They're like, when's John Arderjarko going to come and help me?
The human repair shop, as they call it, is closed.
I love that. The human repair shop. So you know, here we finally do have this escalation of Hyde into like a villain, and that's how it should be. And I feel like if I'm really dissecting this, it's because I am actually sort of trying to work on a pitch for a Jekyll and Hyde type project at that time. Yeah. And I'm just looking at this going like, you know, it's sort of half trying to figure out Stevenson's actual intent with the story, trying to see how that's been adapted into different eras. Cause obviously it was written in the Victorian era. This film comes out in the 1920s in the United States 4 years later, and then 10 years after this, and then about, you know, 10 years after that. And then, you know, we get into more modern iterations. There's a really good, I'm blanking on his name. Who's Anthony Perkins? There's a really good Anthony Perkins version, I think, of Jekyll and Hyde. I think it might have been a made-for-TV movie in the 80s or something like that. I remember being scary. I don't know. I haven't seen it in a while. Maybe it's not. I don't know. There's obviously the Mary Riley movie with John Malkovich and Julia Roberts, which I think it's visually an amazing-looking movie. The transformation's interesting-looking. There's a little digital stuff because it's early digital. It's possibly a little, it's seen through the eyes of one of Henry Jekyll's maids. Mm-hmm. And I think Malkovich is great in it. Julia Roberts's Irish accent possibly detracts from being able to focus on stuff a lot. It's not bad. It's just, it's very Irish.
Unusual for her to do that.
Yeah. And I think they actually filmed it in Ireland or something like that. They filmed it in like a cool, No, so it's for anybody who hasn't seen it, I own it on DVD. I love it. In any case, my point is, I think the Jekyll and Hyde themes of the story are so strong that they allow themselves to be, and kind of basic, they allow themselves to be adapted by every generation kind of.
Yeah.
To shape the story the way they see fit. And also to push against the restraints of the time, right?
Yeah.
What's going to get censored? What's not going to get censored? In the Mary Riley version, you know, he sends her to go pay off a prostitute or a brothel, like the madam of a brothel, who's I think believe played by Glenn Close, and she gets into this bedroom and there's blood on the ceiling, and you're like, like they never show what happened, but you're just like, she's like, there was blood on the ceiling, sir, like, you know, so you know, you can allude to more and more graphic depictions of how evil Hyde gets.
That's very interesting. The whole thing about like adapting for their times, even when they keep with the period, because there's an essay on the Kino DVD. That's one of those sort of frustrating things you have to like arrow through and read like on your television.
That's a little but, frustrating. Yeah.
But it's got cool information. So it's by this guy, Brett Wood. And he's talking about that he sort of focuses on in the 1920s, this idea of like what they were concerned about at the time. So I think in the 30s, I'm mixing sources and all this stuff now, but like in the 30s, it seemed like there was a lot with the evolutionary thing. Like maybe that was kind of, you know, obviously the theory had been around for a while, but there was in the public consciousness, perhaps a little more at that moment. And in the 20s, so they're saying that like syphilis was America's secret epidemic. And it was
interesting.
A disease contracted, as he says, not by chance, but by sin. And so he's talking about like Jekyll's indulging his carnal desires and mingling with prostitutes and drug addicts. And then he sort of catches this disease that makes him disfigured. This is this guy's sort of theory. But the last thing I wanted to say about that was that the real threat, he says, is when we the audience learn that he may then infect the pure Millicent. So that's kind of like when he brings back all of, even just from,
makes sense,
you know, not a what's not supernatural, but not even the height of it all, but just the fact that he's been out there,
right?
Possibly, no, exactly. Getting venereal diseases.
There's a medical risk. Yeah, he's basically put himself into what we now call like a high risk category, you know, of intravenous drug users or
and
sexuality. I neglected in my list. There's a new version of Jekyll and Hyde out with Eddie Izzard. Oh. It's just coming out. I think Hammer released it. It's just called Dr. Jekyll, and I think it's out or it's coming out very soon.
Oh, cool.
It's like a, yeah. Anyway, Eddie Izzard plays it in both male, female versions or something like that. So it's almost, a remake of Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde a little bit.
I was trying to remember what that movie was. I knew they did.
Forgot about that version, right? Yeah. I remember that.
Awesome.
It is interesting. Just this whole thing. If I'm going to lay one more criticism on the film, it's just this idea that I think Jekyll comes off, if you want Jekyll to come off as the good guy, right? This film does kind of a poor job of that, of making him a hero. It kind of turns him into a victim because he's so easily pushed and influenced by Sir George, right?
Mm-hmm.
Into doing this thing that destroys his life completely.
Yeah.
That he becomes just this kind of tragic character. And I don't know, without Barrymore's just skill and just the innate power that he portrays, I feel like Jekyll would become kind of a pitiable character in this movie. But I do think it's the things that make the film great are and we're going to get into the sort of final act here in a minute, guys, but it's, you know, it's Barrymore's performance, first of all, and it's just his look and physicality. It's his performance as Jekyll and definitely as Hyde. And again, it is just these very, the themes that Stevenson tapped into, that, you know, of good, evil, self-determination, weakness, that carry us through. Yeah, a lot of the melodrama of this movie, right? Because that's what it kind of comes into. It's sort of, you know, what am I going to do? It's just the stress and the grief and everything. Yeah, and also,
a lot of hand-wringing, pacing.
Yeah, exactly. That's well said. That's what I was trying to get to. And also, I don't know. I think it's in some other versions, too, the courtyard between Jekyll's house and his laboratory, there must be like 10 minutes of screen time devoted to people just walking from one to the other and back in this movie. Did you notice? There's so, like, every time someone crosses from one another, you have to see, like, oh, he walks over there. I know he walks back. And then finally in the courtyard, the final, you know, climactic kind of scene with Sir George happens. And thankfully, something actually happens in it. Because the rest of it is all just people walking and knocking on doors.
That's right, yeah. And it's very, one of the things I remember most about it is, like, the layout of all that. And I think it is because of that climactic scene that, and I think because of that too, the rewatches for me, like, it's not, I don't see the courtyard and be like, why everybody's just walking all the time. But
we built this set, we're gonna use it.
It's more I see it and I'm just like, oh no, bad things happen back there.
but you're like going like, oh, you know where it's going for.
Yeah, I've seen it too many times. But on the first watch, I might just be like, man, this is like more walking than Lord of the Rings.
It's more courtyard. That's right. Sir George tells him that if he's associated with Hyde, he, Jekyll, can't marry Millicent, even though, of course, he encouraged, you know, him to hook up with other women. So,
such a hypocrite, this guy.
But he draws the line at stomping on kids. So, okay, you know, Sir George has a line. And I think he's happy in a way.
Yeah, he won, kind of.
And he's got some clue that Jekyll is compromised morally somehow. And he wanted Jekyll... Like I said, he didn't trust Jekyll. He doesn't trust a pure person because he himself is so compromised morally. So it's like now that he knows Jekyll's not perfect, he's like, okay, I can deal with the fact that of a guy who's not perfect. I can trust that he's got weaknesses. But having said that, yeah, you gotta no baby stompers.
Yeah.
in your employ if you're gonna marry my girl. So there you go.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah. And he's pushing him. He's judging Henry though, and I think he's enjoying this kind of like I think he wanted to feel superior to Henry, and I think he felt inferior to Henry, yeah. and he didn't like it because he's a man of means and everything. And now that he feels like he's got one over on him, he starts pushing him. And here's this first time where Henry spontaneously turns into Hyde. Jekyll turns into Hyde. He doesn't have to take the potion. It's like an Incredible Hulk thing where he just gets pushed so far that. I mean, we have to talk about, obviously, the influence of this on Stan Lee's creation of the Incredible Hulk, which is, in the last 60 years, you know, in a huge part of our pop culture mythology, hulking out, you know. I mean, he basically hulks out.
Right, yeah.
A lot more I neglected to mention, I think I talked about this in our, yeah, yes, I talked about this in our 31 episode coverage. And I know everybody, I know it's not a perfect movie. I know, I get it. But the depiction of Hyde in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is so good, where he is basically like the Hulk. He's a monster. And the guy who was doing that film, I know, was working on a version of the Hulk that didn't happen. And then Ang Lee's version happens, right? Where the Hulk's digital. Mm-hmm. But they were going to do all the Hulk physically with a real actor in a suit built up to be gigantic with muscles and everything. Huh. Steve Johnson. I think it's Steve. I want to say it's Steve Johnson is his name, the makeup artist. Not Legacy Effects. Anyway, he's done a ton of great stuff. Anyway, I think he got the chance to do that same. You'd use all that R&D on the Hyde character in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, because Hyde's just this huge monster Hulk like kind of character, and it's excellent. It's almost all physical makeup, and it's just freaking, it's cool as heck. The transformation scenes are great too.
I have to check that out. I probably said the same thing when we last talked about it, but I don't think I realized until this time that it's physical makeup. I think I thought because it was going to be giant that it was going to be a digital thing. So I'm fascinated now to see how they do it.
I think he's digitally composited into scenes because he has to be bigger than he is. But no, I mean, you can see behind the scenes stuff of the actor. I can't remember his name. He's a British actor. He's a really good British actor, redhead guy. Just sitting in like a director's chair, you know, built up with all the makeup nice. And everything. He's got the tiny little top hat on his head and everything. It's great. Anyway, yeah, Henry, he turns into Hyde, right in front of him and attacks him Sir George tries to run out the door and he attacks him and kills him. And this is, we're talking about the moment where it really gets scary is seeing him. He hops right in a weird way. Like the way he moves is such a strange, he jumps on his back and tackles him. It's really physical.
And it's really protracted to like his, just like glaring at him and like right into the camera. Yeah. And he's kind of going slow and slow until he's not. Then he just like pounces and feral. And he's just savagely
like a frog or something. Yeah. Something. Crazy. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's kind of the guy throws him off at some point and then he jumps back on him. I don't know if they've got stunt people going for Barrymore's character, but it was tense.
I don't think, because Barrymore was kind of famous for his physicality on stage, and I think this is Barrymore doing his own stunts, as we say now.
Launches at him. It's crazy.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. And then once he's down, as you said, he clubs him and he kind of keeps clubbing him.
Yeah.
Like over and over. Like, he's still hitting him when he's obviously dead. He's still going. Like it's not, you know, Sir George is discovered by Poole. Hyde flees out the back door into his alley and he goes to his rental property where he'd been shacked up with Miss Gina and he starts burning stuff. I think he's destroying like letters or anything, any kind of evidence that connects him to Jekyll, I think. Because at some point they figure out someone knows where Hyde lives.
And I don't know how they know that,
but that's okay.
I was a little behind in the movie there and I forgot they take their time, like after he does kill him, they have that, I don't know how many, maybe like a 10-second shot where he just slowly It's just the scariest thing. Like, yes. As he picks his head up and looks into the camera, that makeup, mm-hmm. that expression.
It's
that,
good. Yeah, the lighting in that moment.
Horrific.
Yeah.
And it's then he goes back to clubbing glee. Him more. It's terrible.
Right. Yeah. Ugh. It's the glee he takes. Hyde has now graduated. He's taken a life. He's taken a human life. And he realizes he liked it.
Yeah.
Is the thing.
That was... And actually, what they do here, because of course he clubs him to death in the 31 film, but this for me like really pays off the way that Carew was so antagonistic to him. So it's actually so much more motivated and perhaps more scary because you know how angry he is at him, and it's not just
you kind of get it. Yeah. Like there's moments where you would like to attack somebody who's being acting like that to you, but we don't do that because obviously we try to be good people and whatever.
Yeah.
But it goes to this idea of, you know, Hyde is Jekyll without any stops.
Yeah, it's like it unleashed. And in this case, he, like in the 31 version, it was all about he was just frustrated he couldn't marry the guy's daughter soon enough. Whereas here, this dude is the guy to provoke him to go to the dark side at all. And then, and so he's like blaming everything on him in a way. Yeah, he really has at him, and that's where it goes beyond, you know, stepping on a kid or stepping
him just
out.
Being a miscreant.
He's
graduated.
Murderer.
He's graduated from being lewd to, you know, to assaulting someone to actual murder. Like the list of taboos is growing. He's getting worse and worse as he's getting physically more and more mishappen.
Yeah, he literally is like a monster now.
He is. Yeah, no, he's, and it's just wonderful seeing this perform, like this, you know, a man who is so tall, like Barrymore was, he seems tall. I don't know. I mean, he seems tall.
He does. Yeah. The other actors. In the other scenes.
He seems like a well-proportioned guy. I don't know. And then he, you know, he does this thing where he turns himself into this like little, he looks smaller. He looks like a hunched creature. It's great. Although it reminds me a little bit of, and take a drink, everybody. He reminds me a little bit of Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein too, when he walks with the cane and everything. Yeah, but anyway.
I know. What hump?
Take a drink, everybody.
I was struck
Millicent's
by something
told about,
in the.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was struck by something in the book thinking about the hunch thing, because they'll talk about his appearance as just being unsettling and off in some way, but often as small and hunched and like a dwarf. And in one of the scenes, they describe that his clothes are ridiculous, like they're.
Yeah.
They're sized for a man like twice his size or whatever. So
right.
They say he actually, I think in the text, it's almost like he looks comical or would have looked comical on someone else, but he's so unsettling that it's, but yeah, like basically that he's so much smaller than Jekyll that it's very noticeable because of the same clothes. So anyway, I just thought.
Yeah, it's like there's actual a physical, almost supernatural alteration on his part, you know, like in the book, like it's almost like he, you know, shrunk.
Yeah. It's like the opposite of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen version.
It's true. I'm trying to look up the name of the housekeeper lady. So all the cops go to the house. Here it is. And, the apartment thing that Hyde rents, and this actress named Julia Hurley, who plays his landlady, who was born in 1848, so what does that make her? Almost 70 plus at the point of the filming of this. And she's not in almost anything. She's in all, like, I mean, she was obviously old by the time silent movies started, so there you go. And she's just, the cops are searching and she's cackling. She's so happy that Hyde is in trouble, you know, because I think obviously he's been this problem tenant for her this whole time.
Yeah.
So she's just unchecked. The actress is just like going for it. She's so big and crazy, but it's really enjoyable to watch. She's just a character. She reminds me of a lady I met in France one time. I had dinner at this old lady's house who had, just to tangentialize, when she was a little girl, her family had to leave their house in France and go up and live in their hunting cabin in the woods because the Nazis came through.
Oh.
So like, that's how far back this lady's, she's passed on since this, but I remember her talking about to me about, well, kind of through a translator, because she did not speak much English, and I I don't speak French at all. Like, I speak five words, but you know, anyway, just enough to, you know, order food. In any case, Millicent's told about her father, and she breaks down. Hyde returns to Jekyll's lab, and he makes the formula that he makes more of the formula that's going to turn him back into Jekyll, but hearing Millicent snobbing on the just on the other side of the door. Like, he's just on the other side of the door of the wall from where he killed, you know, Sir George, and where Millicent is dealing with that. And he finally turns back into, you know, they're trying to figure out where Henry is, because it's like Henry's walking stick is found,
yeah,
half burned in Hyde's thing. So obviously he had, they think he had Jekyll's walking stick, and they're kind of worried what happened to Jekyll now, you know. But he finally, you know, recovers and he comes back out. It seems like as soon as he turns into Hyde again, he realizes what he did.
Yeah, or like,
I'm sorry, as soon as he turns into Jekyll again, I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah, because he does the big, like, oh no, grasping of his face.
Face palm, you know. Yes, face palm, yeah. He face palms. So now he has to go and confront Millicent. And I do like this moment where he, you know, he's still covering. He's doing the, I'll call it the Henry Frankenstein, right? Where he knows he done effed up, right?
Yeah.
But he's still sort of trying to figure out if there's a way through this, if he can fix what he goofed up and not have to answer for it. And again, this is my whole, you know, it's good drama. It's a good character beat. And it's not like you always want your hero to be flawless. But it is definitely this, it's an admirable in your lead character where, like, he's done awful things and he's just trying to lie and cover and not, and get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is, you know, makes it, I mean, at the very least, it just makes it harder to root for Jekyll, you know? It makes him a more tragic character. So he comes out but I do love this moment where he has to comfort Millicent, and she's like, you got to help find Hyde. He's got to pay for what he did to his father. So Henry now has to deal with the fact that the woman he loves part of him, but she also wants part of him dead now, you know, she kind of hates part of him too.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I like.
Well, that's interesting. Because in the 31 version, like, I think he kills her father kind of like, oh, not quite in front of her, but maybe, like, it's certainly not a mystery to her.
Yes.
And so that's kind of an interesting difference here.
Right. Maybe my second or third favorite scene in the movie comes up here where, you know, Henry's sleeping.
Yeah, and this is bonkers.
We have this special effect kind of superimposed character of this spider with Hyde's face on it. And it's so like out of nowhere, right?
Yeah, it's weird.
which is great. It's done very strangely and everything, you know. It's actually, I think it's a double exposure, and it's actually Barrymore in the Hyde makeup, also in spider, in a spider suit, and the spider's really furry. And it's done really eerily. And my whole thing is like, are we supposed to think, is this Hyde's final version? Like, is this what Hyde is devolving to? Right? Like, if we, the idea of like the more crimes and evil deeds Hyde commits, the more he regresses back into some sort of like proto version of a human creature thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, if he were free,
is this like
Henry's body?
Yeah, if he does everything he wants to do and kills as many people as he wants to, would this be what he finally turned into? How he regresses into this like there's almost like twisted something out of the Inferno or something. I like that idea.
Yeah, yeah. But it is strange because it has no, I don't think any antecedent in the book, or I don't think anybody else ever uses this sort of spider imagery, but.
I wonder if it's in the play or something like it's in the play, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to externalize this interior thing. Totally, they do that great trans, it works really well, that one dissolve they do before he kills Carew, where he's standing straight, kind of in the shadows, and they just, it's almost like they dip to black. I mean, it's not a dip to black. It's a dissolve, but it's pretty seamless. It works really well.
It's done well for the time, yeah.
Yeah, this is like some sort of version where we can kind of, I don't know, see it overtake him, like physically somehow, almost. Right. It's weird, though.
Yeah, yeah. And it happens once again after he has the dream. He turns into Hyde in bed. So now, you know, it's again, we talk about it. It's got control over Jekyll. He's turning back and forth, or at least he's turning into Hyde without meaning to. And it's the real problem is that he's out of one of the ingredients of the drug that keeps him turning back from Hyde. So Millicent's worried about, you know, again, Jekyll's done one of his disappearing acts again, and she's talking to Lanyon about, like, you know, I'm really worried about whatever like that, you know, they haven't found Hyde yet. Meanwhile, Jekyll's getting more and more stressed because he keeps turning into Hyde unintentionally, and he's out of one of the ingredients that goes into the potion that turns him up back from Hyde that he has to take. So he's worried that he's going to turn into Hyde and be stuck there. Like, and this has been his worries from early on. And he sent Poole out all over London to get this ingredient he needs. And it's nowhere. This is straight from the book as well. And meanwhile, he's staying in the house because he's worried about going outside and turning into Hyde somewhere in the street. And obviously, you know, getting because now everyone's looking for Hyde. Like the whole idea of him being able to wear this disguise and get away with anything has totally turned on him, because now everyone's looking for Hyde. Everyone, his anonymity is gone.
Yeah.
And he's only safe as Jekyll, but he's obviously at risk of turning into Hyde at any moment. It's such a great, it's a good flip on the character.
Yeah.
You kind of enjoy the things are going badly for Henry at this point, because he has done so much crappy shit that, like, you're kind of like, oh, well, you know.
Yeah, I feel like March...
In a way, you're like, kind of like, that's what you get. Okay, good.
Yeah, it's like, I think March did something about the way they built that character. You feel a little bit more bad for him at this point in the story.
Yes.
He's, like, giving up his fiance out of penance and all this stuff, whereas here,
Right, that's right.
We're kind of ready for Henry to get his comeuppance, I think.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. It's a story of tragedy, and there's a poetry to it, right? That this has to happen. Henry can't get off scot-free from this, you know, this adventure that he started. The makeup's getting much more extreme too, where you know, without any of the prosthetics, just the his hair's messy and his eyes are super shadowed and stuff. So again, the line is blurring between these two, and he's doing like he's hunching more, you know what I mean? It's physically, it's all physical acting on Barrymore's part. And he's there's Poole comes to the door, or no, it's not Poole. It's Lanyon comes to the door. And it's funny, cause I think Barrymore does this thing where it's like, he's trying to stand up straight the way he knows Jekyll does.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like with that erect carriage, but he's already started to hunch over. So when he does it, it's like he's forcing it, and he just looks weird and kind of stiff. It's just kind
I didn't
like,
realize
no,
that.
But, no, I am Henry Jekyll. Why?
That's right. It's almost like he has to practice to be. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be himself.
Yeah. He's having to pretend to be Jekyll, cause he's starting to not be Jekyll anymore at all. He's devastated by the fact that there's no more, ingredient for the formula. And we have a moment that this is in the 31 film where, you know, Henry is, I don't know if he's meant to seem like he's agnostic, but he's not, like, Lanyon has this like more belief in a higher power than Henry more believes in science. But he gets to this point where he's so desperate that he's reduced to falling on his knees and clasping his hands and praying for help. So, you know, I think it's a nice touch, because it's, you know, it's the measure of how bad things have gotten with him that he's willing to ask anybody for help at this point, to help him find a way through this. Millicent shows up to finally talk to him. Lanyon brings her. Henry's still locked in his lab. And just as she shows up, he begins transforming again. We have this great moment where he doesn't want to let her in, and then he transforms and sneaks the door and opens it, and she enters in, and we realize Hyde's behind the door. Hyde is hiding behind the door. he's letting her in, and it's just so amazing. It's such a thing. As he's transforming, though, we see, and this, I had to watch it twice to get back to it. So he it looks like he starts biting his hands, yeah. But what he's doing is opening up the pill box that's in his ring, like the secret pill, and he takes the poison capsule. So he's planned for this, right? Like mm-hmm. he kind of knows like it's all over and stuff like that. So he takes the poison pill before finally transforming, and you know, it's like that with the last bit of his self will as Jekyll. And I wonder if he had to do it with his teeth because
Barrymore
himself could not open it with the fake. Yeah. I think he couldn't do it with the fake, yeah. You know, fingertips that make his hands long. Yeah, I don't think he could get that thing open. So there is one, and someone noted it somewhere else too, where when it's one of the first times he's transforming back into Jekyll as from Hyde, and he's waving around, and one of the false fingertips flies off of his fingers.
Oh, that's great. It's
maybe 10, 11 minutes into the film or something like that. So if you guys are watching this again based on everything, by all means, check that out. You literally see one of his false fingers just fly off because Barrymore's thrashing so much. Here's the moment where, yeah, the door opens and Milson turns around, and there's Hyde looking at her, and he's looking at her in this, like, really skeegy way.
Yeah.
His teeth have become awful and huge, like horse teeth kind of. And here's the bit where, like, it's maybe the most famous shot from the film where Hyde is, we're sort of seeing it from Millicent's perspective, and Hyde is walking straight at us from the camera, and he's smiling. That's what I kind of love about his, you know, Barrymore's version of Hyde is he's grinning the whole time with this awful grin. Like there's no merriment in his grin. It's the grin of someone who enjoys pain and discomfort and everything else in others, you know, and that's maybe the most evil thing about Hyde kind of, is this lack of any kind of empathy. He's shorter than
that's true. Yeah.
He's standing like, right behind her, and he's shorter than Martha Mansfield.
Like, wow. Yeah. Like it's, yeah. Either I don't know if they, Barrymore is not very tall, and or he's crouching a lot too to be Hyde here, but yeah.
I think so. They might have put Martha up on something just to help that.
Yeah. It's worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a great effect. And you see why there are versions of Jekyll and Hyde where you're kind of like, it's a little bit of a Clark Kent thing where you're like, how did nobody?
Yeah, had they not know,
you know, yeah. Notice that it's kind of whatever. Liz Barrymore is okay. Actually, Liz Barrymore is 5'9", so he's not super tall.
Yeah, no,
he's tall. I mean, tallish for the era, maybe, but yeah, exactly. So I could see him just crouching down, maybe. But this version, you could see why no one would ever looking right at Hyde. You would never think, oh, that reminds me of Henry Jekyll.
Yeah, especially like, stage.
There's no similarity. Yeah, especially this stage. Yeah, he's turned into the full-on troll type of a character.
Yeah.
He grabs Martha, and I don't know. I'm not sure what the plan is. If he's trying to kiss her a little bit, and he's just trying to, you know, I don't know. And the pill takes effect, and he starts writhing in agony and falling down and stuff. So, Millicent is able to get away. Lanyon runs in and sees Hyde, and sees Hyde transform back into Jekyll. So Lanyon, you know, finally learns the secret that he's been keeping, but he decides to lie to Millicent and protect Henry's memory, which is an interesting choice, you know.
Yeah, and he was the one that wanted to marry her too, right? So it was kind of an extra
Lanyon's old. Sorry. No, that's
Hutterson. Yeah.
Yeah, Hutterson. Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know, but it's such a great, Henry like Dr. Frankenstein, he kind of pays for his, you know, his, you know, tried to do things not reckoned on by man or whatever, you know. The moral lesson comes full circle, I think, in this film especially, and I think that's well done. You could kind of look at it as Henry self-sacrifices to protect, you know, the one person he really does care about. You could kind of see it as he kind of takes the easy way out and doesn't have to, you know.
Yeah.
Because in the film says he atones for it. But, I mean, looking at it post hoc, you kind of can say, well, you know, this way he didn't have to fess up to his things. He kind of, you know, took the road out. In any case, it comes to a satisfying dramatic conclusion.
It is. But I like it with a little bit better him taking his own life, because it offers maybe some sense of redemption, kind of, but also like in the 31 film, he doesn't, like, he, I mean, he sort of does suicide by cop or whatever, but he attacks them and they shoot him. And I want to say it might be the same in the Spencer Tracy, but yeah, it was just in revisiting the book today. That was when they call it a self-destroyer, I think, in the text, but
yes,
but it has that cool, like, I love the perversion of his profile, you know, at the end, and that kind of,
it is, it's great.
Death rattle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like death rattle dissolve. It goes from the haggard hide.
The sinews of his neck and everything. It's really just wild. It's more satisfying than, Abbott and Costello Meet Jekyll and Hyde, where he tries to climb out a window and just falls on a fence, or he just falls on the sidewalk and turns back into Boris Karloff. You know? The stunt guy, and we end on Barrymore's iconic profile, which, you know, was so popular when he played Hamlet and or whoever in so many things. It's kind of a Macbeth story. If you wanted to make a comparison to some kind of piece of classical literature, it is, you know, it is a man who's driven to do things that he knows, like, aren't right, and has to, you know, face the fact that, you know, of those things coming to light. That maybe is quite a few different Shakespeare plays now that I think about it. But, I mean, it's a beautiful version. Again, I just want to go back and talk about it. Like, it's just photographed lovely too. Like, it's not, you know, as done kind of proscenium style, like a silent movie. It doesn't have, the lighting is subtle. It's dark in a nice way, you know, like the shadows and everything.
Seems
there's
like
this high
actual
kind of
night and stuff
like
too for the.
Right. Yeah. It's just, it's lovely done, but it's still done. You know, it's a very confined thing. There's a few street scenes and stuff, but they're very contained. So it, in a good way, I want to say it almost feels like you're watching a play, right? You're watching here's a dramatized version of this story being brought to you. To the point where, you know, again, as you said, within the film, it lists the actors' names when they introduce the characters and everything. So I guess what I'm saying, I kind of like that it's a little bit of a hybrid of a stage versus a film presentation.
Yeah.
In these earlier days of cinema, right?
Yeah, it's not quite like Dracula felt like a compromise after the first, you know, reel or whatever, but in terms of what they were able to do with versus what perhaps they might have wanted to do. Whereas this one too, like the actual source material, it does take place largely in these interiors, you know, there aren't that many things outside of like drawing rooms and bars and brothels or whatever.
Right. But it doesn't feel claustrophobic.
Yeah. It's got just the right amount of scope, I guess. It doesn't feel too stagey, I guess we'll say.
Because it's a private story. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the performances aren't super big. Like you can see sometimes in they're large. It's melodramatic. It is. But you're lacking some of the really big stuff that you sometimes catch in films of this era, based on, because they were from the stage. And when you're on the stage, you have to perform in a way that like the people in the back row all the way there can still see and get what you're trying to do. So there's obviously a different school of thought, is, you know, stage performance versus film. Wonderful piece. Here's your second Jekyll and Hyde story, David. For us. So thanks for joining me on this one. And maybe down the road we'll tackle the Spencer one. I don't own that one, so I'm gonna have to look around. But
I think it's probably available on one of those archive Warner Brothers things, if nothing else.
Warner Archives. Yeah, I'll bet. As we're kind of rocking through, you know, I We're definitely merging into, we just did Godzilla, everybody, in case you missed that two-part episode. So we're definitely going to be merging into some more sci-fi type stuff too, to be talking about, not least because we've covered a lot of the 30s and 40s, more gothic style horror movies already in our 70 plus episodes. But there's still a few gems from this era that we still have to tackle, and I'm glad we got to dig into this one. David, thanks very much for joining me. Everybody, thanks very much for listening along. We will be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Please check us out on Facebook and Instagram. We're very active there. I guess I'm very active there. I don't know. Livio is too sometimes. We'll see. but we do quite get into some really good conversations there about all these movies we love so much. David, appreciate it again. And we're going to have you back sometime pretty soon for something else.
Anytime.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode of the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode. But the fun does not stop here. You can follow and interact with the show's hosts and listeners online on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Borgo Pass Horror Podcast is a presentation of Shadow Camera Film and Entertainment. This episode was edited by Livio Marino. The music was composed by Sean Poole. Opening and closing narration are by me, Kat Ahrens. Show titles and graphics created by Jim Towns. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast.